Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Didi Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation and host of The Nation Podcast. On one side of the world, a major corporate landlord is evicting tenants by jacking up rents by hundreds of dollars. On the other, its parent company is linked to Israeli bombs, genocide, and illegal settlements. This is the multi-billion-dollar story of American Landmark, one of this country's most eviction-happy landlords. And Elko, its corporate parent, a powerhouse whose subsidiaries are tied to the Israeli military and far-right settler movements. Elko has even been cited by the UN for facilitating human rights violations. Thomas Birmingham spent months meeting the families at the mercy of American Landmark, interrogating the corporate landlords profiting from them, and examining the connection between one kind of displacement here in America and another thousands of miles away in the West Bank and Gaza. He's an investigative reporter and research fellow at In These Times. He's also, I'm pleased to say, a former Nation intern, like me, although a half century later. His story, The Eviction Kings, was produced in partnership with Type Investigations and is published in our December issue. Thomas, we're so excited to have you on the Nation Podcast. Thank you for joining us. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. So you're based in New Haven. This story is mostly set in the South and on the West Bank. How did you stumble onto it?
So this story was born in the weeks following the 2024 presidential election, when there were a lot of conversations happening among tenant organizers and other groups about the degree of Americans' connection to what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank. And many of the tenant organizers I know had started to look into potential real estate ties and the links between, you know, land disputes in the United States in terms of tenants' rights and eviction cases and potential Israeli ownership of those companies in an increasingly private equity dominated market. And I stumbled upon this United Nations Human Rights Office database that lists companies doing business in the West Bank and in these large illegal settlements, and started going through the list to see if I could find any ties to landlords in the United States. And the first company I actually searched was Elektra, which just so happened to be the owners of American Landmark, as you said, a landlord with roughly 34,000 units, 70,000 tenants. And from there, it was sort of off to the races.
Tell us a little bit about the origin story of American Landmark. How did this company come to be, and how did it come to own, what is it, 34,000 units across 111 mega complexes?
Yeah, so the origin of American Landmark comes from a man named Joseph Lubeck, who is the current CEO. He is a former corporate lawyer from Philadelphia, and in the 1990s, he sort of cashed in everything he had to start buying up property in Florida, and launched what was then called Landmark Residential. and very, very quickly found a lot of success in kind of the speculative real estate market. By 2008, he had amassed almost $2 billion. And by that point, the Great Recession hit and obviously devastated families across the country. But Lubeck is sort of on the record talking about how he saw a lot of opportunity in that crisis. And around that time, he met the Salkind family, who are the owners of a company called Elko, which is today the third largest employer in the state of Israel. And essentially, the Salkind family saw the immense success that Lubeck had found in his real estate operations thus far, and saw the opportunity therein. They purchased 90% of Landmark Residential and sort of started this cycle of building multi-billion dollar portfolios together, Elko and American Landmark, and selling them off again at massive gains a few years later. And that cycle has been repeating ever since.
In that sense, Lubeck sounds like a fairly classic, you know, real estate investor. You buy distressed properties, you put as little as possible into them, you flip them as the market rises for more, and then you put your profits into more and rinse and repeat. Did you learn any more about the Salkinds and where they came to Israel from, or, you know, where, how they got into this business?
Yeah, so Elko, what I found interesting is that they are almost as old as the state of Israel itself. They've been in business since 1949, just 1 year after the state of Israel was created. And they have really just become a massive, massive conglomerate in all sorts of different industries, energy, infrastructure, defense contracts, you name it. But part of the appeal, based on a podcast in which a high-up executive at Electra appeared, part of their appeal in getting into the United States real estate market was the potential that they saw in a company like American Landmark in, you know, really transforming it into a full-fledged private equity firm.
And what does that mean? What's the difference between a real estate company and a private equity firm that's invested in real estate?
So yeah, so the difference in what happened when Electra took over American Landmark and helped transform it into this private equity model was it essentially just made all of these purchases that American Landmark was making throughout the southern states where they own property purely speculative. So it necessitates that the rents at all of these properties be raised significantly such that the sort of international network of investors that have their hands in this private equity Electra pot can see the returns on their investment that they're expecting to see when Electra sort of pitches them on becoming involved in the investments in the first place. And as my investigation highlights, the tenants at these properties are very much paying the price of that model.
So from the tenant's point of view, rents go up much faster and they're more less responsive, more detached. I mean, like in New York, for example, everybody who's ever rented an apartment in New York, or almost everybody, comes away not a lover of landlords.
Right.
But it is true that most of the bigger landlords in New York are in it for the long term. They hold their properties for generations. They pass them on to their kids. That doesn't mean that they don't get as much rent as they can, as fast as they can. But it does mean that they're sticking around for a while. Whereas if it's just a private equity speculation, it's like, get in, make money, and, you know, not necessarily any continuity or any sense of long-term responsibility. So I guess that's one difference. And one thing that really I was both fascinated by and impressed by in your reporting is how much time you got from Lübeck and how open he was with you. So how did that come about? How did you approach him and how did the interactions go?
My conversations with Lübeck came in the tail end of my reporting after I'd already been working on the piece for basically 9 months by that point. We essentially compiled all of the reporting that I put together and sent it on over to Lübeck and his higher-ups at Elektra and Elko. We're very surprised to get a very prompt response from Lübeck, you know, with the overall tone of it being wanting to set the record straight on what American Landmark is doing. And in the conversation with him that followed, I was in a strange way refreshed by how honest he was about the model that they're utilizing, because it runs very contrary to my conversations with many other landlords and generally how landlords present the kinds of business practices that they enact. What stood out to me the most from my conversation with him was his admission of the degree of displacement that their company expects when they purchase a property,
which is
they anticipate that as many as 45% of the original tenants of a property will move out as a result of American Landmark taking over the property and raising the rent by, in Lübeck's words, as much as $400 in one go.
Right. And so let's break this down, because
yeah,
it's not just $400. It's $400 on a $1,000 a month initial rent. So we're talking about a 40%
yeah,
rent increase. You know, now, I mean, you know, Zoran Mamdani wasn't the only one to say that the rent's too damn high in New York. But 40% rent increases would never fly,
yeah,
at least in the regulated market in the city. So how do they get away with it? Let's start with that.
Yeah, I mean, in my conversation with him and in remarks we found from higher-ups at Elektra and Elko, the places that their properties are concentrated in is very explicit. They only own properties in southern states, primarily Texas, Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And one particular executive at Elektra is actually on the record as saying that part of this appeal is that they're Republican red states. And there's a quote from him in the piece that says, "In free market capitalism, there are few protections for the tenant. If you want to evict a tenant in New York, you will have a lot more of a challenge than evicting a tenant in Florida." And so that's coming straight from Joseph Lübeck's higher ups, that this model is enabled by the fact that there are so few tenants protections in the states where they own property.
So that's part of their strategy too, is to buy properties in states where there are very few or non-existent tenant protections.
Yeah.
And then when they buy a building, what do they do to justify these rent increases?
A lot of the story follows a tenant named Dyron Kelly in Charlotte, North Carolina, who was living at an American Landmark property when they took over. And he describes the quote-unquote renovations that American Landmark put in throughout the property to sort of justify the $400 a month rent increase that he was hit with right off the bat. He sort of described them as gadgets, you know, light fixtures, door keys that work like hotels, you know, new cabinet doors, but his fridge, his stove, the major appliances were all unchanged.
And also, once you tack on a $400 rent increase for, say, $800 or maybe even $1,200 worth of gadgets, the rent increase stays forever.
Right.
It's not like you have to show that you've paid off your appliances and now it goes down. It just stays up. And then they apparently tack something else on top of that.
Yes. So the $100 to $400 increase is just on the base rent. And in all American Landmark properties, they also have what's deemed a concierge package of additional fees that are almost all mandatory for the tenant to enroll in. These include, a Wi-Fi and cable service, a valet trash pickup service, and a host of other $5, $10 charges that most tenants I talked with had no idea why they were there in the first place. And so that, for many tenants I spoke with, acted as an additional rent increase in the neighborhood of $150 to $200 in the sort of combined total of all of these extra fees that American Landmark rolls out when they took over property as well.
So let's say your net income is $2,400 a month, and you rent this apartment for $1,000 or $1,200 a month, and you're very happy. And then suddenly it's $1,400, and then with concierge fees, you're talking $1,600. Meanwhile, you're still at $2,400 for your net income. So you're now facing the choice between food, gas, heat, and your rent. And probably having to stretch out, maybe an extra week in the month before you can cover the whole rent. So maybe you're late 10 days. Then what happens?
Yeah. And so I also just wanted to note that, most of the tenants I spoke with are very much working class, truck drivers, concert riggers, stay-at-home moms. And so these increases were very devastating when they first hit. So in cases like Darren Kelly's and the other tenants I spoke with, once you hit that 10, sometimes 15-day mark and you're behind on rent, American Landmark will file an eviction against you. They are very sort of trigger-happy, let's say, when it comes to filing evictions. Some landlords, will wait substantially longer or have to wait substantially longer because there are, increased regulations on when landlords can file eviction cases. And when that eviction case hits, there are even further fees that American Landmark can charge to tenants. Now, this is very standard practice for landlords, but I spoke with someone at the eviction lab who told me that on average, a tenant will face an additional $180 in fees every time an eviction is filed against them. And some of the tenants I spoke with at American Landmark said that the fees that they faced as a result of the eviction filings themselves climbed as high as $400 on top of the additional rent, on top of the additional fees. And so there were just many cases in the tenants that I spoke with where it was very apparent just how quickly these costs just spiraled out of control.
Right. And, the reason the story is called The Eviction Kings is because you found an eviction rate that's way out of line, for the norm in a sector not known for benevolence.
Right.
So give us a sense of statistically how much more predatory American Landmark is than other landlords.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to produce a average eviction rate or look at this comparatively, but the Eviction Lab, which is based out of Princeton, gets pretty close, and their average national eviction filing rate hovers around 7-8% every year. And in any of the areas that they look at, the peak of that average they found is around 23%. At multiple American Landmark properties that I visited, that I looked into, the eviction filing rate hits 50, 60, 70, even 80%.
Wow.
So 9 to 10 times that national average. And these kind of exacerbated rates, I found, we looked at thousands and thousands of eviction filings. They weren't concentrated in any particular area. All of the states where American Landmark owns property had at least one property with a greatly exacerbated eviction filing rate. And we also found evidence that these eviction filing rates are a dramatic increase even from the previous owners of these properties. At Darren Kelly's property in Charlotte that I spoke about earlier, the previous owners were filing at a rate of around 16%.
Which is high, but
right,
not...
which is high. But American Landmark is filing there at around 65 to 70%. So the rate quadrupled after they took over.
And presumably, in order to be able to keep doing that, they have to be doing it in a pretty hot market.
Yeah, yeah. Joseph Lubeck was a columnist at Forbes for a brief period of time. And so we get a lot of insight into his model from a lot of those publications. And yeah, he specifically has written about cities in the quote-unquote hottest markets in the Sun Belt. Cities like Charlotte, cities like Richmond, Virginia, like Jacksonville, Florida, where he essentially predicts that the markets in these cities will lend themselves particularly well towards sustainable, very high rent increases. And my reporting found that he was right on the money about that. Charlotte has, in the last few years, consistently had some of the highest average rent increases in the country. And American Landmark now owns roughly one in every 85 units in the city. They have, you know, almost 2,500 units there now. So you can also look at that as sort of evidence of how and why American Landmark is targeting some of their purchases.
Before we turn the corner to the other half of this story, which is its international dimension, which I definitely want to get to, one of the things that was interesting to me about your interactions with Lubeck is that he was totally unabashed. You know, he had an answer for everything. I don't know what I don't know what Elko is paying him, but as a front man, he's obviously very talented. But the claim he made is that these are initial increases, and as they get better quality, as they say, tenants, they'll settle down. Did you see any evidence of that?
I did find that what tenants complained the most about was that very large initial rent increase. And I certainly didn't see any evidence to the contrary from what Lubeck claimed, that once the buildings are quote unquote stabilized, as he put it, through that very large rent increase, they don't feel as compelled to continue to raise the rent by such dramatic rates. But, you know, that also doesn't take into account the massive fees, the fees from the many, many eviction filings.
Well, or the human cost to the people who've been evicted.
Right. Right, of course. And you know, that's, I think, the other really crucial thing here is, you know, these tenants, once they face that huge initial rent increase, you know, many of them hung on for as long as they could. Dyron Kelly successfully paid his rent for almost a year after that large rent increase, but it eventually just became, he had exhausted all of his savings. It became so out of reach that he was eventually evicted and spent the following months on the street afterward. So, right. Yeah, there's a very, very severe human cost.
Right. Well, that's as good a bridge as any to the connections between this kind of displacement here and settler activity in Israel and in the territories. So talk about Elko, the parent company, and their relationship with the settler movement and their place in that ecosystem.
Yeah. So like I said earlier, the UN Human Rights Office has this database where they track business activity in the illegal West Bank settlements. And Electra/Elko actually shows up in there twice under two of the subsidiary companies, of which there are many. The first of which is involved in these massive infrastructure projects, particularly the development of a large tunnel in Jerusalem, which will connect one very large illegal settlement with Jerusalem and make it much easier to facilitate movement to this settlement.
This is Male Adumim, which
Correct.
Is like 40,000 units.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I spoke with a member of the Settlement Watch team at Peace Now, which is an anti-settlement advocacy group, who talked about how the development of roads and tunnels like the kind that Electra is developing, they've seen that result in dramatic increases in the population of these settlements once those roads are completed. Now, Electra's other subsidiaries include Electra Afikim, which is one of the largest public transit operators in Israel, and many of its bus lines go directly to illegal settlements. They own branches of grocery stores in the settlements, a whole host of just very intrinsic business relationships in many, many different sectors.
Let's lay this out for readers and listeners. You know, this matters not just because, you know, the settlements have been deemed illegal by the UN and by American policy up until the current administration, but also because if you think that there is ever going to be a two-state solution, there has to be territory for one of those states, for a state of Palestine. And settlements like Male Adumim are exactly in the way of any peaceful resolution of the current conflict. So by entrenching the settlements further, they make any peaceful settlement further out of reach. And it's interesting because one of the dynamics that you capture really well in the piece is you quote someone pointing out that the settlements were built by committed ideologues, but that doesn't mean that everybody who lives in them is a committed ideologue. And you say that when this road is finished, when this tunnel's finished, you can either pay for a two-room apartment in Jerusalem or for the same price, 10 minutes away in a settlement thanks to this road, you can get a five-room apartment for the same rent.
Yeah.
So again, it entrenches the position of these illegal settlements in Israeli society and makes it far more difficult to imagine a future in which they're not continually occupied only by Jews.
Right. And, you know, that's one sector of Electra and Elko's involvement in the subjugation of Palestinians. But my reporting also found that there are also very heavily intertwined with the Israeli military amidst the ongoing genocide. We found this quote from the CEO of an Electra subsidiary that states, quote, "The IDF is a major client. We stand shoulder to shoulder with them in facing challenges and fulfilling missions. We are likely the only supplier that can say we've expanded our areas of deployment. This is a great source of pride for us." And this was in 2024, well into the genocide. And they've also helped, Electra has also helped construct and maintain multiple Israeli military and police training facilities. So even on top of the business activity in the illegal settlements, there's also a extremely direct link to the military operations as part of the ongoing genocide. Yeah.
And yet there was something else you put in the piece that I was intrigued by, and I don't know whether you follow it up or will follow it up later or not, but you quote Lubeck saying, "Some of our biggest investors are Muslim countries from the Gulf, from Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Qatar."
Yeah.
So do you have any further information on that, or was that certainly an interesting quote?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm in the process of trying to scope that out a little bit more, because that really stood out to me as well. And again, I think speaks to my sort of odd feeling of being refreshed by how willing Lubeck was to just be honest about the depth and breadth of his operations. But yeah, it certainly seems like based on what we found about how their operations are playing out in the United States, I'm very, very curious to keep digging and find out more about what their operations might be entangled with elsewhere in the world as well. Yeah.
I hope you'll continue doing that work in the nation. Let's talk finally about your sources for this story in terms of the tenants. What more can you tell us about Kelly and Mary Napier and some of the people you introduce us to in the story, where are they now, and you know, and what are their circumstances?
So Kelly, like I said, spent months homeless after he was evicted by American Landmark. He was, since he's a truck driver, he was showering at rest stops, you know, sleeping in his truck. He tried to find room at a shelter in Charlotte, but they were full, which is another sort of layer of our housing crisis that Kelly sort of found himself face to face with. So that's kind of the extreme of where some of these tenants end up. Another case, like you mentioned, is Mary Napier, who only moved into an American Landmark property after her house burned down, and she needed somewhere fast to stay. And American Landmark, unsurprisingly, makes it very easy to sign a lease and find a place in one of their buildings. But with the combination of the fees and all of the extra things that American Landmark tacked on, which she felt very misled about, she also was eventually evicted just a year after she moved in, and is now kind of in a situation that is common among a lot of the tenants that I spoke with, where she's moved in with family or friends in a space that is very much not equipped for the number of people that are currently living there. She's living in a single room, essentially, with her two children. And I think that really gets to the degree of displacement that American Landmark is perpetuating through its model, is that, you know, when these tenants are evicted, they're not finding new places of their own in most instances. They're having to move in with people who already have their own kind of setup. And so it's just constraining people and sort of hanging people out to dry in wide scale. Like we said earlier, 45% of their 70,000 tenants is well over 30,000 people. And so that's, it's very, very widespread impact that we're looking at here.
So we've talked about this story having two halves, the sort of half in the U.S. and the half in Israel. And how would you describe, aside from the corporate link, what else connects those two halves?
The thing that I think I'm going to take away the most from this piece is processing the degree to which my reporting on American Landmark here reveals new and horrifying ways in which the average American might be connected to what's happening in Gaza and in the West Bank via the costs, demanded of people for their housing through their rent money. You know, in the year that she lived in American Landmark property, Mary Napier sent American Landmark some $15,000, and that money was then funneled into this network of Elektra and Elko and their investors across the world, but also included in their operations in the West Bank and in Gaza. And so I think, given the fact that they have, like I said, some 70,000 tenants right now who are going to be paying rent on December 1st, I think it begs the question of how entwined the average person is in ways that we might not even anticipate because of our increasingly corporately dominated world.
Thomas Birmingham, thank you so much for coming on the Nation podcast, and thank you for your article in the December issue. Take care.
Thanks so much.
The Nation podcast is produced by Jack Merkinson and Adam Smith Perez. Our interns are Laura Noor Walton and Leo Miranda. And you can get us wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Didi Guttenplan, host of the Nation podcast.